This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, February 22nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. When Donald Trump was elected, he handed over operation of his real estate business to his sons, Eric and Donald Jr. This week, Don Jr. was in New Delhi to meet potential buyers of Trump-branded properties there. India is the Trump Organization's largest international market. Full-page newspaper ads there announced that Trump has arrived. Have you? Raising questions here about how much he may be exploiting his father's position in the White House. On Tuesday, Don Jr. was interviewed on Indian TV.
When people talk about it these days, it's, you know, profiteering from the presidency and all this nonsense. I was like, wait a minute, I can't do deals. I've spent over a decade creating relationships to now where we have five incredible deals that are all active. We could do so many more, and we're not doing those, but no one wants to talk about those kind of deals. It's sort of a shame because we put on these impositions on ourselves, but essentially got no credit for actually doing that and for doing the right thing. I'm not saying it was wrong.
Adam Davison joins me to discuss how the Trump family applies its business practices to politics and how its refusal to abide by the rules that normally apply to deals in both worlds has led to some of the administration's most serious problems with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Welcome back, Adam.
Hi, Dorothy. Great to be here.
So this story about Don Jr. in India was almost overlooked amid all of the other stories that have been breaking in the past week or two, you know, the Mueller indictments and the tragic shootings in Florida. But I thought it was worth pausing to discuss what this shows about the intersection of the president's business and political practices. And you've done some deep reporting about the Trump Organization's work abroad and about the role Trump's older children play in it. Could you just give us a quick snapshot of the sons' roles?
Sure. I've spoken to, you know, a lot of people who work now or have worked at the Trump Organization over the last two decades. And this picture of Don Jr. as surprisingly sort of a tragic figure emerges. I mean, the story about Ivanka Trump is consistent. She's smarter than her dad. She's more ruthless than her dad. She's more cutthroat and frankly, vicious. I mean, a cruel, difficult boss. That is a picture that emerges about Ivanka. The picture about Don Jr., and I've talked to people who knew him very well, worked very closely with him, is that he came into the company as a very sweet guy who had some ideas, maybe not the most brilliant ideas in the world, but his own ideas about how to appeal to a certain type of outdoorsy audience, and that his father was just vicious to him, horrible, just beating him down, beating him down. And so the Don Jr. we see now, this person who is, you know, so simultaneously offensive and hurt and wounded and angry at the world and defending his dad at all costs, you really get the feeling this is not the essential Don Jr. This is a creation of a very cruel and unpleasant young adulthood under his father's tutelage.
He also sounds like his father, very much like his father in that quote we just heard, both defensive and absolutely on point about how they do what they do and the lack of shame.
And they get no credit, no credit.
No credit, and, yes,
and
the grievance.
Now, we say the kids. I have to say, Eric Trump just never comes up. Nobody ever talks about him. He's really a non-entity in the conversations I've had.
But does he play a significant role in the company?
He officially, yeah. I mean, he co-runs it now with his brother. And certainly it's possible that, you know, he's growing into that role for all I know. But when you talk about the Trump children as forces in the business, it really is Ivanka and then Don Jr.
Yeah, and we'll get to Ivanka in a second. But getting back to what Don Jr. was saying, when his father took office, they did put some restraints on themselves. What were those, and are they holding themselves to it?
No, they did not really put restraints. I mean, I think what all of the ethical experts, the watchdog groups, what really just basic practice would entail is that the company would either be sold off or completely put in a blind trust. And they did not truly put restrictions on. As Alan Garten, the lawyer for the Trump Organization, has said, they said that they would abide by some rules, but they felt free to remove those rules at any time for any reason. And Eric Trump has said that he talks to his dad about the business. We've heard other reports that the president is very involved in the business. But the restrictions they said they put on, the strictest blanket one is no new international deals, but they very much said we will continue to do existing deals. And so that's why this trip to India is so interesting.
Yeah, and we'll get into the international deals more in a second. But getting back to Ivanka, as I understand it, the company's venture into 3- and 4-star hotels in this country, that idea was initially pushed by Ivanka. And I wondered how that's going.
Yeah. So this is actually quite interesting. If you think of the Trump Organization when it was fully run by the dad, it's a very volatile company. Big, high-profile swings. Some of them hit. Most of them miss. And it's playing in this very volatile space of kind of super luxury hotels. It's a very risky business. There's this other business, the sort of 3- and 4-star hotels, the Hampton Inns, the Hilton Garden Inn, you know, all of those things you see when you're driving on a highway in America. That is a very stable business. It's very predictable. And from what my sources have told me, Ivanka was really leading this effort to create this new concept, the Scion, an American idea, 4-star and 3-star hotel brands. And everything they've been saying for the last several years has been, that's our focus, that's our focus. And you might have thought it would be really successful because the president has been revealed to be far more popular than one might have thought in at least some parts of the country. And that is not the case. It's a disaster. I mean, they launched the Scion brand before the election. They launched American Idea last year, and they've now signed up a grand total of one hotel company, a small company in very rural Mississippi.
But why is that, given what you've just said about the predictability, sort of how you go about making money in that market?
So the way a quick primer on the way the hotel business works and these kind of those hotels you drive by on the highway, those are owned by some local franchisee. They are wildly disproportionately Indian Americans, and they need each of them to be successful for 20 years. You're signing a 20-year commitment. And you need to know that company, that brand name, is going to still be bringing in, as they say, heads in beds for 20 years. I think that if you did a rational evaluation right now of will the Trump family, will the Trump organization be sustaining a business 10 or 15 years from now, I think it's an open question. I think even a conservative Republican who really likes Trump would be inclined to question that.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So let's look at India as kind of a case study of how the Trump Organization goes about doing its business abroad. Why is India the Trump Organization's largest international market, and what has Don Jr. been doing there?
First of all, they have these five major projects just in India alone. So most countries they're in, they have one deal. Generally, it's sort of they meet a typically a kind of third-tier oligarch type. They work with them to build one luxury tower. In India, they have this thing that, as far as I know, as far as I can find out from the public record, is the only licensing deal they have, where there's this person, Kalpesh Mehta, in India, who is authorized to sign new deals. And if you go to his website, you will see this is open for business in an aggressive way. So in other words, I believe they interpret their own promise as, we will not have any new deals, but we have a deal with Kalpesh Mehta, this guy in India, and he is free to sign new deals. So as far as we know, the only country in the world where the Trumps can, while keeping to their rather vague and imprecise promise, actually sign new contracts with, for new buildings and new construction. That's not, as far as we know, why Don Jr. is there. He is trying to flesh out, you know, some existing projects. Although there, too, you see the problem because, you know, a real estate deal, particularly a luxury housing deal in this case, you're selling the property, the actual units, the apartments, to somebody. And any review of basic ethical guidelines is this is fraught with the potential of corruption. I mean, it's how are those units being priced? Are they paying more than the fair market value? We know from past projects that they are, you know, they'll often sell 50 units to the same person in properties where there is no legitimate business reason to buy 50 units. I mean, there's clearly something going on.
So how do they do that? This is a company that needs a massive infusion of cash now. How do they do that?
So this has been my, you know, basically my obsession for a year now. If you look at what's publicly available, and this is a private company, we don't have access to their books, although we can assume Robert Mueller does with subpoena power. Looking at the surface, this is a business that forever has been always very close to collapse. The big savior that kept them afloat post-2006, when they were in a real crisis, I mean, a real almost out-of-business crisis, was getting to these international markets and doing it in a very specific way. The way they worked with international markets was a volume play. You'll sign a deal with anybody. You make them give you $1 million, $5 million up front, and then most of the projects fail, but that's okay because you got paid up front. That is not the standard business. Four Seasons, Ritz-Carlton, other companies, they plan to only do successful projects and make money over 20 years. That is not the Trump model. The Trump model is volume, volume, volume. So that major volume has collapsed. They don't have, at least publicly, that kind of volume of the international deals. So a solution was, oh, good, we'll do domestic. We'll shore up our business with this new 3- and 4-star hotel domestic business. That has been a disaster. It's hard to see how they are not in serious, serious trouble right now. So what are they doing? Where is desperation taking a company that never had very high ethical standards?
So this is where the Russians come in. Let's go back for a second to Don Jr., who said in 2008 at a real estate conference, boasting that he'd visited Moscow 6 times in 18 months, and he admitted, and I'm quoting him, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." What was he talking about?
The truth is we don't fully know. It is a picture we're trying very hard to unravel. But we do know that many, many, many Trump properties, the individual apartments and condos, went disproportionately to Russians. And we also know that many of his projects, there were people with very close ties to Putin, to the Kremlin, who were involved in financing and developing those projects. And so we see basically a Manhattan-based real estate business post-2000 shifting from a fairly traditional, you know, you get money from big banks and you invest in big projects in America, to a business kept afloat disproportionately by these former Soviet Union partners, both on the big end, on the developing a building end, and on the small end. We're still talking about condos that cost millions and millions of dollars, but smaller than a big development. And so there's a lot of these warning signs that there could be money laundering, foreign corrupt practices, sanctions violations, other criminal procedures. We do know that the Trump Organization was essentially did no due diligence, did not follow standard protocols for making sure its money was clean. And so what do those Russians know, and how do they communicate to the Trump Organization what they know? That is kind of what is obsessing not just me, but every reporter right now who's covering the Mueller investigation.
And Robert Mueller himself. So he's indicted Paul Manafort and gotten Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos to plead guilty to lying to the FBI about their connections with Russian officials. Let's just focus for a second on Manafort and how he's an example of how people close to Trump monetize their relationship with him.
Sure. So I don't know of anybody who believes that before 2015 and really 2016, anybody in Russia thought Trump would be president. I think it's much more of happenstance, where you sort of have this world of Russian oligarchs who are getting money out of Russia, Donald Trump figuring out how to plug into that network and make a lot of money. So I think all of a sudden, this kind of, you know, this guy who I think there's evidence that people like Manafort, people like Putin thought of as a buffoon, it suddenly looks like he could possibly be the most powerful man in the universe. He moves up the ladder of elite. So Manafort actually had much more high tone oligarchs that Manafort had worked with, much richer oligarchs, much more powerful oligarchs. And suddenly this kind of buffoon becomes a focus of attention, a source of incredible power. I have personally talked to several people who imagine they themselves would make hundreds of millions or billions of dollars by being intermediaries between corrupt oligarchs around the world and the Trump Organization post-election.
This takes us really directly to this famous meeting in Trump Tower in the summer of 2016, attended by Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, who was then the chairman of the campaign. The meeting was set up at the request of a Russian attorney. Those present have said that the only topic of discussion was Russian adoption policy. Tell us what you make of the meeting.
I mean, to me, much has been made of this meeting, to me, to this day, it nowhere near enough has been made of this meeting. We now know that there was, on some level, collusion. I mean, collusion is not a precise legal term. You know, I looked up the dictionary definition. It's working together secretly to further your potentially illegal or unethical aims. And that is exactly what that meeting was, explicitly. Hey, Don Jr., the Russian government has nasty secrets about Hillary Clinton. We want to secretly give them to you and help you. And Don Jr. said, yes, let's do it. I love it. And so, yes, we have collusion. Done. Now, was it illegal? Was it impeachable? That's for other people to decide. But I don't understand why we're still discussing whether or not there was collusion. For me, the most interesting thing, I spoke with a bunch of American scholars who study this process of kompromat. So there is a longstanding Soviet, and as I understand it, even under the czars before the Soviet Union and certainly very much under Putin, practice of kompromat, which is basically collecting information about everybody with any degree of power. And, you know, essentially you can assume that anyone who is quite wealthy in Russia has gotten their money in some way illegally. And you can also assume that the Kremlin has the proof of it. And we have seen the evidence of this with Khodorkovsky and others, that when someone falls out of favor with the Kremlin, they're brought up on charges of getting their money illegally and put in jail. It's just a way of doing business in Russia and much of the former Soviet Union. And when I talk to scholars who study it, they say the way you use it is you do not call someone up and say, hey, pal, I've got all this information on you. If you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to release it. It's more powerful if you just hint at what you have. Because once you actually tell someone what you have, they can go to their lawyers, they can figure out how serious it is, they can defend against it. If you just hint at what you have, that is truly, truly scary.
So you think that Putin has kompromat on Donald Trump, and that is why he absolutely refuses to say anything negative about Putin, including about the facts that we now have in hand, thanks to Mueller, about Putin's information warfare campaign in the run-up to the election?
What we know is that Trump did a lot of things that had the hallmarks of high risk, high potential for illegality in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, and with people from the former Soviet Union in North and South America. We know that. We know that Donald Trump is exactly the kind of person, even long before anyone thought he might be president, who Putin would have collected a huge amount of information on, of a prominent, famous American doing business with all these oligarchs. What we don't know is what exactly does Putin have. maybe, you know, and possibly there is nothing, but presumably there is something, and how exactly that was communicated. Now, it struck me in this famous Don Jr. meeting in Trump Tower, you know, it was this weird thing where this lawyer who we now have strong evidence was working for Russian intelligence approaches Don Jr. And you would think that might be a discreet meeting, but she brings this cast of characters. It's like every 5 minutes, remember, we found out about there was this guy from Azerbaijan, this guy from Georgia, this guy from Kazakhstan, and or who had done business in Kazakhstan. And it just struck me that she was bringing people from each of the countries that the Trump Organization had either done business or tried to do business in the former Soviet Union. And this is very much in keeping with what we know about how kompromat is used. You don't sit down and say, I know everything, here's what I know, you better do what I say. You sit in and you say, oh, you know my friend from Azerbaijan. In fact, you did that very interesting project in Azerbaijan. You know, that kind of thing. I will tell you, it feels to me like we are seeing the fairly naked and not particularly hidden state of Russia has kompromat on Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, and that is controlling his actions. There's no other explanation of the facts that is so conducive to explaining what's going on.
Thank you, Adam. To be continued in coming months.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Adam Davidson is a staff writer and a regular contributor to NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.